Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
So I spoke at an education summit for Microsoft. I also spoke at an education summit for Apple. At the Microsoft summit, I would say that 80% of the executives spent the vast majority of their presentations talking about how to beat Apple. At the Apple summit, 100% of the executives spent 100% of their presentations talking about how to help teachers teach and how to help students learn. One was obsessed with their vision, one was obsessed with where they were going, the other one was obsessed with beating their competition. Guess which one is frustrated in this competition? Because the finite player is playing against its competitors, and the infinite player is playing against themselves. The infinite player wakes up every single day and says, how do we be better this week than we were last week? How do we perform better next month than we did this month? It's a game of constant improvement. It is totally fine to study our competition for tactical reasons, but the number of companies that study their competition for strategic reasons is scary, which means they react strategically to their competition and will change entire business models on a whim, which means the company has no stability and is going all over the place. In other words, you're wasting time and resources, and you're frustrating the people on the inside because they don't know where they're going. It's a constant game of reaction. A long time ago, in a previous life, I used to work at an ad agency. And I was a junior kid, and I worked in the competitive analysis department. And I worked on one of the telephone company clients that we had. And my job was to report to the client on what the competition was doing. Now, the number of other telephone companies that existed in America that day was quite a long list. And the client couldn't afford to study them all, so we studied a handful of them. So think about that for a second. They're studying their competition, but they're only studying some of their competition. Well, what about all the others? Not to mention the fact that in the infinite game, it's usually the competitors we don't know about that take us down, not the ones we do know about. MySpace had no idea that Facebook even existed until it completely destroyed their company because they were so focused on the ones they did know about. And I find that fascinating. Because remember, in the infinite game, we don't always know who all the competitors are. So at the end of my talk at Microsoft, they gave me a gift. They gave me the new Zune when it was a thing. Zune was the competitor to the iPod. And this thing was gorgeous. An absolutely spectacular piece of technology. Beautifully designed. The user interface was beautiful. It was intuitive and simple. It was a really remarkable piece of technology. It didn't work with iTunes, which means I couldn't use it, which is a different problem. But the technology itself was really quite sophisticated and quite stunning. So after I got done with my talk at Apple, I'm in the back of a taxi with a very senior Apple executive, sort of employee number 12 kind of guy, and I decided to stir the pot. And I turned to him, I said, you know, Microsoft gave me their new Zune, I said to him, and it is so much better than your iPod Touch. To which he responded, I have no doubt. Conversation over. Because the infinite player understands that sometimes you're ahead and sometimes you're behind. And sometimes your product is better and sometimes it's not. The goal is not to win every battle. The goal is to outlast the competition. You let the competitor compete against itself and drive itself down to zero while you're out there improving your systems constantly. This is what it means to play the infinite game. And I've become totally fascinated by this because the companies that frustrate their competitors, the ones that seem unbeatable, the ones that everybody targets but seems unable to reach, accidentally are playing the infinite game. So in the US, Costco frustrates Walmart. But if you listen to Jim Senegal, the founder of Costco, he talks about building a business for the next 50 or 100 years, not for the next 1 year or one quarter for Wall Street. He talks about the need to take care of his employees first, his customers second, his shareholders third, because that's the way he will build a long-lasting company. And it is true, when we prioritize the needs of the shareholders, which, by the way, is the equivalent of a coach prioritizing the wants of the fans over the needs of the players. That's what shareholder supremacy is. That doesn't build a strong, stable team. You may win a game, you may even win a tournament, but you won't build a team that can win year after year after year after year. Southwest Airlines frustrates all the other airlines in America because they're competing against themselves. They put their employee number one, they put their customer number two, they put their shareholder number three. That is the order in which you play the infinite game, because that is the order in which you build stability. But companies that have it in the reverse order go out of business or are merged or acquired because they run out of the will or the resources to compete by themselves. I'm totally fascinated by this. The vast, vast, vast majority of businesses don't know the game that they're playing, don't know the game that they're in, which means we're all playing by the wrong rules.
Hey everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the show. Today is Wednesday, July 18th. We open today with a clip of Simon Sinek. He is the man who popularized the concept of the infinite game. We are going to talk about that in today's conversation in great detail. I am very pleased to welcome back to the podcast Skinner Lane and Moritz Behrling. They last appeared on School Sucks Together mid-November 2016. That was episode 460. It was called Time to Grow Up, Abandon Anti-Attitudes and Embrace the Infinite Game. At the time of that recording, both Skinner and Moritz were working with Exosphere Academy. Skinner, founder, Moritz was the director of research. The Exosphere Academy project is still up and running and growing, but both Skinner and Moritz have expanded their focus to additional projects. We are just going to scratch the surface of one of those projects in today's conversation. This is actually the first of two parts. In the second show, we're going to be doing a deeper dive on what one very exciting project they're both working on, called Vaxios, is all about. But this first conversation focuses on an expansion of this concept of the infinite game. We'll talk about how to develop the mindset for playing the infinite game, how many people out there are schooled to prefer finite games, why even if we do embrace the infinite game, we need to play finite games as well, and why we can't live in a world where everybody plays the infinite game. After that, we will transition into a discussion of the problems that the Vaxios project aims to solve. Skinner discusses Vaxios as a tool to end digital slavery by creating a real market for information and the means to catalyze a true information-based economy, which is in many ways the opposite of what we have today. In the next show, which should be coming at the beginning of next week, we'll go into greater detail on how Vaxios is going to work. And just one quick note before we start the show today. Before the end of July, I am going to have to sit down with you folks and catch you up on everything that's been happening. We are going to do a conversation about the future of School Sucks, the future of Brett Vinat. There's lots of changes happening right now, and they are positive. In addition to a lot of behind-the-scenes work with School Sucks Project that you're going to be finding out about soon, I'm also going through one of perhaps the biggest transition of my life, and I can't wait to tell you more about it, but it's too long a story for this monologue. I assure you that we will be getting back on track definitely by the beginning of September with weekly productions and bonus shows. So keep an eye out for a Future of School Sucks conversation coming before the end of this month. Also, if you're interested in hanging out with me on a ship in the ocean, there's going to be an opportunity to do that this October. I'm going to be one of the speakers on the Contra Cruise. If you don't know anything about this, Tom Woods and Bob Murphy have a podcast called Contra Krugman, where every week they get together and tear apart Paul Krugman's New York Times column. This show has built a tremendous following. Obviously, I'm a huge fan of Tom's. I'm a huge fan of Bob's. I'm really, really excited and honored to be a part of this event. It's happening this October. If you want to learn more about it, you can go to ContraCruise.com. I hope to see you there. And something, I don't know, something in my gut tells me that, like, you should be there. I was thinking about this the other day. Like, Tom and Bob, both religious men, right? Both very familiar with the Bible. And they're trying to put as many of their listeners as they can on a large floating vessel. So as you're making your plans for the fall and contemplating attending this event, maybe you should just ask yourself, what do they know that you don't? ContraCruise.com. So that's it. Let's get started. We're going to review Exosphere and the concept of the infinite game, and then we're going to expand both of those topics in the next hour and a half. Thanks so much for listening, everybody, and take care. I am very pleased to welcome back Skinner Lane from Exosphere. Hey, Skinner.
Hey, Red. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. You are in Santiago, Chile. And also joining our conversation again from Hamburg, Germany, Moritz Berling. Hey, Moritz. How are you?
Hey, I'm great. Great to be here.
You have a new project, right, that you've been working on since our last show was 20 months ago, so it might not even be that new anymore.
Yes, I can definitely talk about that. So, yes, I've been sort of after Exosphere moved to Brazil, which was another one of the bigger steps we took, and one of the many ones we probably won't get into too much detail. But after doing that, I ended up actually deciding to move back to Germany for a while. I headed back to my parents' place in Hamburg, sort of took a 2 months of reorientation, and then again ventured out, started working at a blockchain startup in Berlin. And then at the tail end of that gig, I saw some signs picking up where a project that I'd been following for more than 4 years had sort of steam gathering. Like, there were signs that they were picking up the pace, that stuff was getting real. And this project is called Holochain and also Holo. And these are sort of two post-blockchain crypto projects. And mm-hmm. So that's what I'm working on right now as a consultant slash contractor, helping them out with partnership development, communications and solutions design, and currency design actually too, which is a very interesting subject of its own. And sort of hoping to see this through and basically start to draw a lot of the people who are currently interested in cryptocurrency from the mostly financial aspect away from the existing solutions and start to actually think about how to add real value rather than just become another hypercharged parasite on the financial economy.
Excellent. And you are also still involved just as a consultant with Exosphere?
That's right. I'm the senior strategist for Exosphere. It's basically an advisory position to help Skinner and the directing team make sure that the strategy is manifesting in the right tactics.
Excellent. So I am going to present this to the audience as a sequel to our conversation in November of 2016, which focused mostly on both of your work with Exosphere. But Skinner, if you could just review what Exosphere is and what Exosphere does for people who might not have heard that conversation, I'd definitely appreciate that.
Sure. Exosphere, we call Exosphere a learning and problem-solving community, which is probably the least sexy tagline for an organization, but one that we have stuck to just because it's really the most accurate description of what we do. And the Exosphere Academy is designed to be the sort of next, let's say, post-institutional institution for learning and research. And we started in 2012. I posted our sort of 27 theses of education reform and started that the intellectual framework for what we're doing in 2012. And we've been in full public operation since our first boot camp in 2013. And the project has continued to evolve toward what I sort of originally hoped it to be, which is a learning institution that is focused on the infinite game mentality. So rather than a finite game, of graduating, getting a piece of paper, and then exiting the educational environment, the learning environment. We want to create an institution that people become members of and continue to conduct learning and research as a lifelong vocation, rather than as something to get a credential and go flash that piece of paper in exchange for a slave wage job in the corporate world.
That actually brings us to the next thing that I wanted to talk about. But just to gather up the intro here, Skinner, you're in Santiago, Chile. Moritz, you're in Hamburg, Germany. I forgot to mention I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which has many nicknames, but it is also called the City of Industry. And it was named that at a time where the industry basically choked the people who lived here, caused all kinds of health problems, and drowned the city in a cloud of smoke. And, you know, now in the 21st century, this city's had a renaissance. That smoke is cleared. It's clean and beautiful. It's one of the most beautiful cities in the country, certainly that I've been to. You know, there's a real technological revolution that's happening here. It's a city that sort of embodies the transition from one type of work or one type of industry to another. So it was nice that I happened to be here. One of the best received parts of our previous conversation was our discussion of the concept of the infinite game, transitioning away from playing finite games and embracing the infinite game. It's right in the title of that show. Now, my understanding of this idea is, if we just want to focus on education, a finite game is basically you're done with this when you get a diploma. Is that a fair assessment of the finite game in education?
Yeah, I think that it goes even a little bit further, which is that the way that we approach things like standardized testing are also wrapped up in this finite game mentality, which is the idea that that learning or education is a game to be won.
Right.
That somehow a person can win that game is sort of absurd at the beginning.
The idea that there's a finish line.
Yeah, right. I mean, not only that there's a finish line, but even like at these sort of key milestones that we give awards to students for being valedictorian of their class or scoring the highest on some standardized test in this competitive framework that is really, I think, at its core, contrary to the entire notion of a liberal education,
sure.
Which is, it's sort of as ridiculous as talking about winning the liberty game, being the most free and getting some sort of prize. Like all of this, because it's the same thing. I mean, learning is liberating, and the idea of the liberal arts, as Aristotle envisioned them, was to be to have this entire corpus of knowledge so that you weren't merely performing a function and therefore kind of enslaved to the people that had the ability to understand the complexity of the world around. So to us, this is a lifelong unfolding. It is something that takes different tacks and trajectories depending on not only the circumstances of one's life, but the evolution of one's curiosity and the other goals that a person has. So if we take the current educational system and the more accredited the environment, the worse it becomes in this way, which is that there are these arbitrary metrics that constrain learning, and create artificial opportunity costs, saying, well, if you are teaching at an accredited university or at an accredited high school, for example, you have to teach certain things, and that inherently crowds out the possibility of teaching other things, and so we end up with this educational monoculture that is the opposite of liberating. It actually creates what we know as Overton windows, these narrow ranges of acceptable discourse and inquiry that's really absolutely anathema to the idea of classical liberal education.
Now, most people think about this maybe in terms of higher education and the opportunity costs, but from somebody who worked on a secondary level, if you actually go through the process of creating an IEP, right, an individualized education plan, the most bureaucratic bean counting that you could ever do with education, and you see how much time is sucked into a pursuit like that, which has nothing to do with embracing or fostering curiosity or creating an exploratory environment. It really just is, you know, checking boxes. So-and-so will increase competency in this content area by 25% by this date. Like, these were the forms that I used to have to fill out. I mean, right. I got into teaching because I was so inspired by a college professor. And then, like, I remember working in special ed and writing these things and thinking to myself at, like, 11 o'clock one night, why would anybody want to do this? Or how could anybody be excited about this? And so much opportunity was lost for people who stay in that career, never realizing that there are other ways to embrace education. Like, so many people with so much potential as educators get stuck there. And so many students with so much potential never get to realize it because of that system.
Yes, we completely agree. And the bureaucratization of education is even, I mean, we're on an even worse trajectory still. Right? Mm. It doesn't show any signs of abating. In fact, it seems that there is a movement to just continue to make it worse, and I think that is it's sort of consistent with this old line that the bureaucracy expands to meet the needs of the expanding bureaucracy.
Exactly. Yes.
And that, I think that's exactly what we've got, and it's really, it comes at a high psychological cost to teachers, to administrators, to students, but in the long term, to all of us, to society, to the future of technology and scientific progress and everything, all are suffering because of this arbitrary paperwork game that has supplanted meaningful education.
Absolutely. And just one more fact to add there. Since the time that I was in first grade, the administrative arm of public schooling has increased over 500%, right? So you think about administrators, these are mostly people making six-figure salaries, great benefits packages and pensions, all funded by taxpayers. So there is also the huge opportunity cost of the money that is sucked into that system. As the bureaucracy grows, you need more people working in an administrative capacity, or so we are told. And we've had this massive expansion of wasteful positions that has drained so much money away from the productive side of the economy just since, you know, the middle of the 1980s. So we've definitely outlined a problem, and that gets people excited about the possibility of solutions. I would like to hear each one of you weigh in on mindset as far as embracing the infinite game. Young people, I think, are fully aware, whether they're in secondary school or college, they look out into the world, they see these domination systems, they see these status quo institutions. How have you each developed a mindset that has allowed you to embrace this continuous effort, this infinite game?
Perhaps I'll start because it's sort of closer to my my experience with school and then also leaving that behind. So, I mean, I was always a good student in school. So personally, on an experiential level for myself while being in school, it was never really an issue. I am good at sitting still. I'm good at concentrating. I'm good at suppressing the energy that would otherwise make others sort of kind of leap up, become the class clown, and disrupt, in air quotes, the flow of information download into the minds of our willing students. Wink, wink. But yeah, like after having left school, even I, having been through the experience and sort of finding it pretty enjoyable, even I had a lot of trouble actually acclimating to what you should really call the real world, where, oh, suddenly I am in control of my schedule. I need to make plans. I need to hold myself accountable to the plans that I make. I cannot expect somebody else to structure my daily routine. And all of these things, when you have been habituated in the earliest parts of your life to really have somebody else do that work for you, makes it really hard to take back that that task into your own sphere of agency and then to move forward from there. And so when I did that, it was a really painful process of having to try out things and then failing and then sort of dealing with the emotional struggle that comes also as the consequence of sort of this mindset that if you fail or if you don't reach the right grade, then you have, like, you're defective. And so in my personal path, I actually dropped out of two university programs. I was sort of stupid enough to go back a second time, if you will, and ended up leaving that behind to, at the end, move to Chile and work with Exosphere. And so that's really where I first experienced an environment with people that were intent on putting their own skin in the game for their own ideas and to suffer the consequences, be they what they may.
How old were you when you started?
So I left school at 18. I left my last university program, I believe, with 21. And then when I went to Chile, that's about the time, I think, 21. Yeah.
Wow. So yeah. Have you found that developing that skill set of self-direction has been itself an ongoing process? I mean, I started to promote these ideas on School Sucks in 2013. I was having conversations about productivity problems that I'm having yesterday. You know, so that was a conversation I was having yesterday about, man, you know, I really need to square up here and fix this and be more conscious about that. I mean, that's kind of a continuous process in itself. I mean, we do over time, I think, accumulate better habits that produce better, you know, workflows and better outcomes. But are you still finding that to be a continuous challenge?
Oh, absolutely. It is a never-ending, infinite game, if you will. So it's, I would say that the most progress that I have made in any area is really to take a more self-forgiving, but also simultaneously more self-exacting standard to how I approach my work and to see no clear boundary or no necessary boundary between leisure and work. And I feel like that's another component that sort of reinforces this notion that you have to get a job, you have to move on further and further upwards always, never downwards, of course. And that sort of reifies this idea that work is something that you hate, that you get paid to do, and that you need to sort of distance yourself from to maintain any kind of sanity. And it's a sort of bungeeing back and forth between something you hate and something where you sort of finally are at peace again. And so that's been really something where, I mean, we're recording this podcast on a Sunday. Who does that? I guess just people like us.
Hey, it might be Sunday for you. Saturday. For us.
Sorry. Yeah, you're right.
Oh, wait. Is it Sunday yet for you?
No. It's
Saturday.
Wait.
You're only like, what, you're 6 hours ahead? 6 hours ahead of Eastern time, probably. Yeah. Okay.
Yes. That's right. Definitely Saturday. But like other people, because their work is primarily constrained within the span of the 5-day work week, and because it is also constrained within the 9-to-5 and all of these things, like they're more paid to be there rather than to see opportunities and capitalize on them. And so recently, David Graeber, one of the great anthropologist of our time, has started talking about, and actually he published a book about the idea of bullshit jobs, that currently our economy has a large percentage of its job market consist of bullshit jobs where you are just there and you are paid to do basically nothing. You actually have no function. There's frequently these stories that come out that some guy in the Spanish bureaucracy like has not shown up to work for 15 years, has been getting paid all the time, and sort of actually studied Voltaire in his time that he didn't spend on work. So it's this weird idea that actually a lot of this even the jobs that we do have in the supposedly productive economy aren't even productive, but they're sort of necessary to keep social cohesion in place.
You said a couple of things, Mertz, that I definitely want to come back to because I have questions, but I'd like to hear Skinner's answer to the same question first.
For me, one of the most challenging transitions from formal education to the rest of life was in fact this fuzzy measurement of whether you're succeeding or failing. And as an entrepreneur, it's even fuzzier when you go from a world where you get you know exactly what you need to do, you do it, you get an almost immediate feedback, and then you move on to the next thing. That is so disconnected from and I mean, even I would say it's actively dishonest about the world.
It's artificial.
Yeah, it is lying to children about the world, and particularly if you don't go into the standard career framework, it's really like jumping into ice water. To transition from that world where everything is very legible, you know what to do, what not to do, and you're just optimizing. And so then you succeed or fail merely at how good you are at optimizing for those parameters. And that's the problem with finite games. The rules are clear and you know what to optimize for. And then the winners are just the people that do the best optimization. Whereas the real world and the infinite game mentality says there are never clear objectives. You never actually know what to optimize for. In some cases, you have to decide what you want to optimize for. And so that requires a completely different approach to life, because, well, how am I supposed to know what to optimize for? How do I know what I want to optimize for? This can only be done through experimentation, and a lot of times that experimentation is purely accidental. There's a lot of even within this the community of people that are doing that are living this way, there's even sometimes I think this mistaken idea that your experimentation is that you set out and run this intentional experiment with the scientific method applied, and that's how you figure things out. I think that also is kind of this arbitrary, artificial framework imposed on something that is far more complex and undefined. So to me, the most difficult process has been learning that there is no end to the process of discovering what to optimize for. That it is that itself is part of living an infinite game life. Is that you are always having to figure out what you want to be when you grow up.
It's not even only that you have to choose what to optimize for, but even beyond that frame entirely, sometimes the question isn't what to optimize for, but what should you satisfy? What should you like? What are the different conditions that might be enough, and then you don't have to optimize more. And so, sometimes we think that there's a game, that the sort of optimization is itself an infinite, finite game, but the sort of the question is more, what is a self-sustained life that can bring sort of means and ends into harmony and continue to dynamically evolve as the conditions change?
Do you guys think there's a lot of people who kind of reach that place and say, this is enough? This level of sustaining is sufficient, and I just kind of want to maintain this equilibrium? I mean, I could certainly get by keeping things exactly as they are. But that's not, an attractive path forward for me. I think that most people who are doing this would feel similarly. But there's this other voice that I'm really not thrilled that it exists. But a few minutes ago, Skinner said, you know, this is the problem with the finite game, right? All the boundaries are clear. The expectations are laid out. The checkpoints are well established. That's the problem. A lot of people, I think, have been schooled to say, no, that's what I love about it. That's what gives me comfort about it. I've certainly had days where after, trying to pursue a new path forward and realizing I was on the wrong path and had to go back to where I was when I, where I started and find a new path, I've said, gosh, I wish I could just turn this over to someone who would be my boss and tell me what to do. Do this, do this, do this, and then do this. Now, that isn't like the prevailing mindset for me in my work, but it's definitely a thought that I've had in moments of frustration. And I think that a lot of people are embracing the finite game in education and in the rest of their lives because it has a predictability, because it has a comfort, and what lies beyond that might be absolutely terrifying and can be terrifying. And I think all of us have maybe had that experience. Maybe it's not like sheer terror, but it's at least discomfort. So I'd like to hear Right. each of you follow up and just talk about dealing with that discomfort and maybe even a specific challenge that you persevered through that have emboldened you to go forward or feel like the embracing of the infinite game was the right decision, was the right path for you.
Yeah, I think that the response to the infinite game this is terrifying is the most natural response. And the attractiveness of finite games, of abiding by social norms, et cetera, it's very clear that this is attractive. I mean, it's extraordinarily attractive. The German psychologist Erich Fromm wrote a book called The Escape from Freedom, in which he details why right. Europe was attracted to fascism. And it's precisely this. And there's a huge mistake being made in the discourse, the political discourse today, where fascism has become a word that is just sort of a catch-all for something that people don't like, like a set of political ideas that people don't like. Right. And this is extremely dangerous because what it does is it actually inoculates people against being able to notice real fascism. And one of the key mistakes that is being made, I think, in this discourse is that people have come to this view that, well, how could anyone have ever gone along with fascism except racism and such? Like that must be the only – that's why Europe succumbed to fascism. Mm. So if you approach this question – and I think this is really at the center of the question of how to live one's life. It's not merely a political question. If you don't see the inherent attractiveness of fascism from the perspective of the people who succumb to it, that, and you just call them racists, then you are likely to miss fascism when it does arrive in your own time. And I think that, in fact, the best artistic treatment of the subject is the Amazon series, The Man in the High Castle, which is based on a Philip K. Dick novel, if you just look at the aesthetics of the Nazis or the Japanese in America, which is the way was what is portrayed in this series, you see this sort of attractiveness of everything being very tightly controlled, of the aesthetics being all clean and similar, and everybody sort of knowing their role in society, because there's attractability to that. You know where you stand at any given moment.
In the first season of the show, you also don't see, and this might be part of the genius of the writing, you also don't see a lot of this could never happen here type of moments, right? If you think about the day-to-day interactions between the occupiers and the occupied.
Yes, it's extremely normal looking. Mm. And I think that this is the reason that we are kind of in a dangerous moment is that a lot of people are succumbing to fascism and don't realize it. But they're succumbing to fascism first in their own mind, and that infiltrates the rest of life. Like the political life is just a reflection of millions of individual minds. And this is where Carl Jung was more or less predicting the dark cloud of fascism that descended on Europe a decade in advance because of the analysis of the dreams of his patients. And I see not sort of in dream analysis, but in the way that people utilize technology and accept certain parameters of their technology, I see a deep acceptance of fascism already. And so then when it works its way into political life, people are shocked, but they don't realize that it started in the mind a decade, two decades before. And the only way to stop fascism is to reject it first in your own mind for your own life, not looking for anyone to just take over and tell you what to do. And that anyone doesn't have to be a person or an entity. It can merely be a response to signaling and depersonalized incentive structures. Like that is sufficient. And I think that's another of the key mistakes here is that people think that fascism comes in the form of a Hitler, but it doesn't necessarily. It can come in many forms, depersonalized forms. And our technology stack is really, I think, the place where that comes out the strongest today. But we wouldn't have given into that had we not already been conditioned through schooling to accept social incentives as they are presented at face value.
So, and these deep regularities, I would also add here, that sort of the idea that everything has to be legible at all times, which is then carried forward into all your other parts of your life, that you need to impose some structure on it. You need somebody else to have some structure imposed on you so that you feel at ease. And I would just sort of bring what we just talked about in the sort of abstract way a bit down to the concreteness. And also say that infinite game, you can't really play the infinite game as such by itself. You have to play the infinite game through particular finite games. So you can actually exist within sort of the existing structures. You can play the games, or at least outwardly be appearing to play the games that other people find legible and need to be legible for them to structure their lives around, but then sort of have a broader informational substrate, I would say, in your mind and in your being behind that, so that when you see in that game a rule that doesn't actually contribute or a player that is abusing the rules to further his own ends and exploit the other players in the game, that you can point to that you can assemble people around that personal perspective that allowed you to call that out, to spot that problem in the existing formations, the existing institutions, and then to reorganize them on the fly with the people that you are able to show your personal perspective, and for them to then see that as valid and useful as well. So I would just reiterate, go ahead.
Yes, I think the key point there is that you have to play finite games. That's the only way to make money, for example.
Right.
And probably the only way to meaningfully influence people. But you can't have your identity wrapped up in a particular finite game. So one of the problems with the formal educational system is that people wrap up their identity in the letters that come after their name. So it's not, there's no like if a person wants to go get a doctorate, you know, I have no objection to that. I'm fully in favor of people studying, and if they want that formal qualification, then good. But you know, if your identity becomes having PhD after your name, and then you start to use that to make judgments about other people's intellectual prowess or ability to contribute to conversation, that's when it instantly becomes a deficiency rather than an advantage. And the trouble that we find is that that people fall asleep in their particular finite game, and they can't see that they say an illusion. It's a helpful illusion, perhaps, but an illusion nonetheless. So the ability to play a particular finite game while remembering that the finite game is not the totality of life and reality, this is the challenge. But in self-reliance, Emerson, in fact, says that that you should confide yourself childlike to the genius of your age. Dive in and play the games that people are playing, but do so with a higher level mentality.
Right, not at the myopic level that they're usually
exactly.
played. Okay, sure.
Precisely.
Okay, so let's use the opposite example. When I embraced the philosophy of liberty, let's say, I was at a kind of crucial time in my life as far as making a lot of long-term life decisions. And I think I made a lot of mistakes and applied a kind of zealotry to my decision-making at that time, maybe 10, 12 years ago, and wound up so far away from the tracks, I've almost had to figure out a way to break the rules of every game that people around me are playing, you know, without going into too much detail, I'm always trying to find a workaround for almost every real world thing that I'm trying to do. And lately I've had to return to the tracks and really, in some cases, to solve certain problems. I know I'm being very vague, and I hope this is okay, but I think you get the idea. I've had to play the game by the rules of the game, or certain finite games by the rules of the game. So I think that there's a balance that a person has to strike between not developing an inside or myopic view of the finite games that must be played, but also acknowledging and accepting the fact that those games exist for a reason, they have a function, and there is probably benefits to operating inside that structure to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think that, in fact, an important heuristic here that I think can be helpful to a lot of people in your audience as well that might be following the same kind of trajectory of going needing to go against the grain all the time. And I'm speaking very personally and from experience, painful, difficult experience on this, that in the end, if you are always doing the opposite of what everybody else is doing, then you are just, you are not a contrarian. You're actually equally as defined by the system.
Yes.
If you're being defined in opposite.
Yeah.
So I by just doing the opposite of what everybody else is doing is not self-reliance in the Emersonian sense at all. It's actually just the same as the people that are doing exactly what they're supposed to do. So it's sort of like if you're hiking. I love spending time in nature and spend a lot of time hiking. And you're like, well, I don't want to follow the trail here. And you get off on in the middle of the thick brush and full of ticks and mosquitoes and snakes and whatever else. And you say, you know what, maybe going off the path just for the sake of going off the path is not necessary. Like, I could enjoy the forest on the path more than in the middle of mosquitoes and ticks and snakes. So maybe for a while, the path is all right if it's better than where I'm standing right now. And I think that there's some kind of need to know that the path is there and you can walk on it when you feel like it. And when it makes sense to go off script or off the path, to do that. And so not be tied either to the script or the anti-script in either direction.
Absolutely. Yeah, the example in skiing that I remember seeing a lot and standing at these like boundary lines where it says like, hey, if you go on the other side of this line and you get hurt, no one is coming to get you. Right. And
right.
standing there and actually trying to do this calculation of like, well, is it worth it? Isn't there excitement on the other side of that line? Now, if people only operated outside that line, they'd obviously all be dead or, you know, freezing to death eventually. But inside that line, it might be boring compared to some things outside that line, but there's plenty of fun and plenty of satisfaction to have inside the line. So that's like,
yeah,
you know,
boring is not always so bad.
Yeah, I mean, so that's kind of the trick that takes us back to what you called the problem with the finite game versus what other people would say is the solution of the finite game. People really do like predictability and the embrace of fascism, right? People like to know
right.
what to expect. They like to know what the boundaries are on themselves and other people. You know, Thaddeus Russell, who's been on my show a whole bunch of times, has always talked about the Puritan voice inside the head. Adam Curtis in his film called it the policeman, or I'm sure that he was borrowing that concept from somebody else, but the policeman inside the head, the self-regulated individual. All of these ideas have been very attractive to people in power or the scientific managers of society back to the beginning of the Industrial Revolution.
I would just add something here, which is that we cannot actually afford for everybody to be playing the infinite game at all times.
Indeed, right.
And sort of without finite games that are being sustained, because then there's no legible systems for us to actually see what other people are up to and to sort of coordinate our own movements with them. And that's really absolutely crucial for society to sustain sort of any modicum of an existence. So I would definitely say that. And then also that sort of the work that people like you, like us and other people who have this intense longing, intense desire and drive to add something to the human experience and sort of go beyond the bounds of the currently existing structures. What we are or what we are doing is really we're taking the risk on our own shoulders. We're happy with sort of suffering the consequences of our own perhaps mistakes, even when we go outside those bounds. But then the beautiful thing is that if enough people do that, and at least one or two of them are successful in finding something, some gold, some information out there in the forest, and can bring that back to the tribe, then we can all learn as a community from that learning. And pushing the boundaries actually ends up adding to everybody else's life as well.
Right. Everybody benefits from what a small number of people are willing to do. You know, it's kind of like the transition from being a traditional school teacher. You know, you look at just the procedures and the expectations of a job like that. That's for everybody, right? At least according to America as it's set up, or the world as it's set up now, everybody goes to school. This is, you know, broad and open and everyone does this. Versus to what I do now, which I've definitely realized through a lot of like SEO research throughout this year, is almost for nobody. At least as far as like who's looking for this information right now or who's willing to invest in what we offer right now, compared to school, that's almost nobody. But things like this
right.
that are for almost nobody are still more lucrative because of the passion and the motivation that that small group of people actually has. Everybody else is just going through the motions of the thing for everybody. Right. Because it's for everybody. Everybody does it. Everybody has to do it. There's very little passion or excitement, enthusiasm about any
There's
of that.
No marginal cost.
That's that's important, too. Right.
Yeah. And I think that we can. There's a very good example of this in an area that's sort of near to the work that we do, which is in Thomas Kuhn's work on the history of science. In his very seminal book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he distinguishes between what he calls normal science and revolutionary science or paradigm shifting science. And you know, his point is that the skills that are necessary for normal science are different from those that are necessary for breakthroughs in the paradigms. But without normal science, we would have no science. Like if all of scientific inquiry were just trying to break whatever the dominant model is, rather than trying to hone the dominant model and debug it as much as possible at the margin, then we wouldn't really get any useful applications of science. So you know, the regardless of the fact that that classical mechanics was overturned in the last century, it did not detract from the centuries of work that were put in to hone the Newtonian model. And certainly all of our modern luxury in life is derived from the work that was done to hone, clarify, and improve the Newtonian model. And so even though we know that there is a lot more going on than that, that so-called normal science was critical to the Industrial Revolution. It was without it, we wouldn't have had the Industrial Revolution. So in the same way, accepting what people are doing that seems to be working doesn't make one less of an iconoclast or less of a contrarian or anything like that. It just sort of makes you sane and rational.
I think this is related, so I want to return to it before we get too far away. Moritz talked about the lack of a boundary in your life, Moritz, between leisure and work, right? And
yes,
we've talked about this very idea from a variety of different angles for the last 15 or 20 minutes. But this is something that I've really struggled with. Like, as I've, you know, tried to find a new place to live, it's like, well, should I really have a home office, or should I be like getting office space somewhere so I'm actually like going through the motions of going to work so I can make this separation between the leisure part of my life and the work part of my life? This is something that I've struggled with. I want to know, and I think like we've kind of built this idea up at this point, but how do you guys manage that? If that's an ideal to have no boundary between leisure and work, how do you manage that?
I would definitely say that that's not my ideal at all.
Okay.
I should probably clarify. I don't mean to say that you should have no boundaries or that you should like that. Those things should bleed into each other seamlessly. What I would rather say is that they should not be the sort of these opposites that you have to alternate between and that are existing in a structure that you yourself cannot change or that you sort of have to fit yourself into. So I think it's very, very powerful actually to use structure consciously, as you would do if you were renting an office, to be able to sort of have some clear starting point to your day that forces you to, in the morning, actually get up, leave the bed covers behind, go take a cold shower, and then head to work, and then sort of make that actual shift in your mind that is necessary to put in the effort and the motivation to do what you need to do to continue. So in my personal life, I definitely I do separate those things. I do have some routines. Currently, I'm traveling so much that it's very hard to maintain any particular one routine because my surroundings are often so different. But in general, I would say that it is absolutely crucial to think of these as sort of things that can be changed as you go, and that a particular structure that exists is not absolutely necessary for them to for you to be successful.
Well, I think when we separate, if you put things into the two categories of work and leisure, for a lot of people, and I've seen this, the contrast between the two becomes so much more ugly. Like, work is something that people come to resent when contrasted with leisure. So I think you're saying that life is more, there's more of an intertwining of the two in life. Is that fair?
That's definitely fair. And I would just say that if you have a relatively full life in the sense that it challenges you to do things, you are not just dialing in, you're not just sort of a passive person that's sitting in the passenger seat of somebody else's car, then you can play with those boundaries. And that's really what I want to say, that you can take the car off road as you would, or just take the highway and get to your destination if you are playing in that finite game. So that's definitely more accurate, I would say.
And I want to transition to a discussion of a new project that you're both working on called Vaxios, which I think is a continuation of the infinite game theme here. You guys told me before we started that this new project is something that's grown out of the work you've been doing with Exosphere over the last 6 years and will actually return to provide funding for Exosphere in the future. So I'm going to pass it back to Skinner, and I'd like you to tell me about the genesis of Vaxios and what the aim is for this project.
Sure. When we started Exosphere in 2012, we assembled a set of texts of sort of some dead and some living authors, and the living authors included a handful of people that that we thought were making some prescient analysis of the direction that our technology has taken. So one of those people is a increasingly well-known personality from Silicon Valley named Jaron Lanier. He's currently at Microsoft Research, but he's famous for having coined the term virtual reality and was a very early pioneer in the 80s with the earliest virtual reality technology. And for quite a while now, he has been trying to bring into public attention the dangers of the way our technology has been designed, and particularly social media. His first book was entitled "You Are Not a Gadget," and his second, "Who Owns the Future?" And now his third is, I think it's titled something like "Why You Should Go and Delete All of Your Social Media Accounts Right Now," something like this. So he's taken kind of an increasingly unsubtle approach to getting his message out there, probably because people are not hearing him.
Right.
So we started. Really seriously engaging with Lanier's ideas at the beginning of Exosphere, and has been a key part of our curriculum since then. And then Exosphere in 2016 became the first educational institution to do in-person teaching of Solidity for Ethereum, and so we've been very heavily engaged with blockchain for a number of years now. And so these things kind of converged this year, in particular with Holochain kind of coming to the fore and doing their ICO successfully and getting their project live. The idea of Vaxios came out of this, which is that we can take the new tools of distributed ledger technology, and in particular, Holochain's agent-centric approach to data, and actually create an alternative social software platform that embodies a lot of the ideas that Lanier has about the way technology should have been, our technology stack should have been created from the beginning, and actually create informational markets. We believe that our social interactions through software should be mediated a lot like our social interaction through goods and services, which is that there should be a price discovery mechanism through the market. We know that I'm sure a lot of your audience are people that are strong believers in kind of anarcho-capitalistic models or believers in markets, et cetera. Mm. Well, we think that the market for information should exist in the same way that we have markets for shoes and cars and everything else, and that currently we effectively are living under technological communism. So just the fact that Facebook has private shareholders to me doesn't really diminish the fact that it has effectively the role of the commissar of our social lives. At least on the internet, and
sure, where you're the product, and you know, like I think that everybody, certainly, I hate to admit this, but it's true. Like I've encountered things online and experienced some kind of disappointment. Like, oh, it costs money, I can't just have it. Right. Like everything, I can just have. as long as I'm willing to be the product. Yeah. So we're all conditioned. I think at least I'm happy that I at least realized that that's a problem in my thinking. But yes, most people just have that expectation that everything they engage with on the internet is going to be absolutely free and they're not going to ask any questions about it.
And it's that lure, really.
Of course. Yeah, it's irresistible. So that's why this message maybe and why Lanier's had to keep like upping the explicit nature of delivering that message, you know, because people aren't listening because the lure is too strong. It's like, hey, you don't think about this. You can just have it for free. You know,
right.
I know what it's like to tell myself a story about, you know, a too good to be true offer. Sure.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same phenomenon as the fact that today you can go and look at the complete, utter, total ruin of Venezuela and find people on the internet that are still actively advocate socialism, because as the old saying goes, there's a sucker born every minute. And there are always people that will be willing to believe that you can have something for nothing, even when all of the empirical evidence is to the contrary. And so as a result, like, even though people know deep down, I think, that their interactions on Facebook and Google and their purchases from Amazon, et cetera, are not nearly as good of a deal as they've been led to believe, at the margin, the fact that they can have something and feel like it costs them nothing keeps them coming back. I mean, and this is the it is the insidious nature of the technology stack that we have, that people are going back for something that costs them more than it gives them in almost every measurement. And so we live in an attention-starved world because, well, that clicking on that BuzzFeed article doesn't cost me anything. I don't have to pay for it. And I think that if we have functional informational markets where people are paying for information that they consume, then they will start to have the same attitude about free things in the digital world that they have in the offline world, which is, well, wait, what's the catch here? Well, you're not just going to give me food. You're not going to give me a car. So what's really going on here? Now, shockingly, they don't have that filter in the digital world because they don't really have to pay for many things in the digital world. So if we just take our offline logic for markets that's functioned very well for a very long time in the production of physical goods, and we apply that to information, I think what we would find is that people do start to calculate opportunity cost. They start to see that going and spending 2 hours scrolling through Facebook is costing them money rather than saving them money or gaining them something for free.
And not just money. It's also other things of life that they value. Like the attention they can actually put on things that matter to them, like their family, their friends, or their personal movement forward.
Their emotional health. Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, that's a real problem that I think a lot of people are struggling with, that I've talked about struggling with on the show in the past, you know, coming to view the world through that being the window to the world for a lot of people, and how it changes your whole thinking towards, you know, people in your actual real world life. It is I think a serious problem for lots of folks out there. It has been for me. It was one of the reasons why I got up and left and drove across the country and back at the end of last year, because I felt like I was letting too much of my time and attention sink into that window, that screen. And I was actually at times losing touch with a lot of the things in life that I should have been grateful for, that I should have taken time to appreciate. And you know, I mean, maybe there's other people who are better at balancing than I was, but it's certainly something that is a struggle for a great many people.
And I would also say here that this is partially the reason of which, and Skinner already alluded to this, the reason for this might be, or definitely to a great degree, is that we are sort of spread thin. like spread thin across all of these different services, platforms, email, protocols, like apps, all of these different separate and sort of incentivized spaces that have an incentive to spread your attention thin, to suck you in, to make you not value your attention and the connections and your movement forward that you actually probably your higher part, the higher and better part of yourself wants. And the reason for this is because of the infrastructure of the internet and how it has developed over the past 30 or so years since its inception. I mean, I would just say, like, at the beginning, the idea for the internet was, as Tim Berners-Lee put it out, to actually have everybody appear as a peer in a network where they are on the same standing with everybody else, where they have their own server. So in a sense, they have their own space, their private space, which with which they show up in that new information highway that they control, that other people can visit according to the rules that they themselves lay out. But the problem with that infrastructure was that it is very, very hard for the average person to run their own website or to create their own server or to administer all of the difficulties that come with this technical infrastructure. And so over time, we ended up developing more and more centralized spaces like Facebook, like Twitter, like YouTube, all of these ones that make it very easy for the average individual to sort of show up, sort of know how this all works, and then to engage with other people. And so in the process of that, they gave up that sort of freedom underneath to have their own space, to structure their own experience, to they themselves assemble the tools they need in a way that serves that better part of themselves. And so as a consequence today, we see this, all of these political polarization discussions, all of these sort of breakdowns in civility and general human decency have at least partially a root in an iterated finite game of being drawn and being manipulated by algorithms, by sort of the incentives of those shareholders of Facebook and other giants like them to spread your attention thin, to waste it, and to then basically become predictable. This is sort of deep irregularity that allows them to sell you more things. And so the reason why Skinner was so adamant about sort of casting all of the learnings that we've had over the past 6 years at Exosphere into a new project and really push this forward, at least from my perspective, is that the game changes completely when you put, like Google Maps did, you in the center. You as the dot on the map around everything, around which everything else sort of arranges itself. And that same image that you have when you have Google Maps open and you're walking to a destination where the sort of the services and the information and the sort of the path that you can take, you have decided, and the relevant information is being shown to you as you need it. That's sort of the image that I would just suggest to people to look at Holochain and sort of the idea that Vaxios embodies of giving you the tools that you need to show up in cyberspace as a whole human being and to take back sovereignty over your own data, your own information, your privacy even, and your connections to other people.
Also having control over your attention and there being a skin in the game dynamic on the other side that in the same way that at least historically, if I wanted to send you a piece of mail, I had to pay for the printing and postage. And that had a real hard cost, not just my time. And that definitely limited a lot of the nonsense that now just floods the internet. So like, part of the problem that we have here is that the marginal cost structure of all of life, all of informational transmission history, there was always a high marginal cost for transmitting information. We reduced it almost overnight to zero. And look at the confusion that we're in as a result. And so like markets are actually a way for people to impose costs on the producers of externalities in information so that I can say, hey, my if you want to put something in front of my face for me to evaluate and decide if it's valuable, you need to pay me first and then I'll evaluate it. And if it was valuable to me, then I can reward you so that you come back to show me something else that I might find valuable in the future. This is a completely radical upending of the paradigm that has built Facebook and the other major platforms that we use today.
And that autonomy is absolutely gone.
Right. And actively circumscribed by the platforms themselves. Doesn't want you to curate your feed. They want to curate your feed for you.
Oh, imagine if Mark Zuckerberg had appeared on the internet in 1995 with the value proposition that, look, you surrender your privacy to me and I'll create a hub for all these disparate chat rooms that you like to visit, which is what Facebook is today. Right? Those chat rooms right. don't exist. Or I'm sure in some corner of the internet, there is still ways to interact with other people like that. But Facebook has basically replaced all of that. And now they are the curator of, you know, your information. And now it's loosely based on preferences that you're stating for most people, but it also is creating this kind of terrarium for you to be in.
And they have have all the incentives to put a lot of the money that they make into researching more and better ways to draw your attention further away and to just erode it. I mean, that's the reason they can. This is so hard for so many people because they study intensely the psychology that goes into how people spend their attention and their time, and then they use that to erode your attention. And the reason they can do that, the real problem here, that if you change that, everything changes, is that all of our data is in one place and it is not ours.
Right.
Yeah, it's sort of like, I mean, what we've seen actually is this convergence of the Stanford and Harvard models of manipulation, like Stanford and Harvard Business School models of manipulation. The Stanford School has always been based on basically Skinner box manipulation. And I'm aware of the irony of the
name. I almost said it earlier in the conversation. I didn't want to make things awkward.
No, it's okay. I'm used to it. But the Stanford School of feedback loops.
Right.
Is basically just Skinner box manipulation taken to an extraordinary engineering level of implementation. And the Harvard School of image-based advertising marketing manipulation. These two clouds have converged to form a supercell that is just literally wiping out human consciousness for anybody that happens to be in its way. And, I like to bring up relatively arcane and unpopular topic of which is the subject of the ancient idea of idolatry, which the word comes from a Proto-Indo-European word that means to see, and the reason that images were prohibited in the Abrahamic religions and all of them in the Ten Commandments is that people are easily manipulated with image. And so when you combine the Harvard marketing with the Stanford model of feedback loops, you get this pernicious, like truly pernicious outcome of Facebook and fake news. So people have lost, as a result of all of this, people have lost the ability to use language to reason. Marketing has corrupted people's ability to use language, and now we have just this proliferation of language denigration happening across the spectrum, from the political correctness and social justice warriors across to things that seem kind of benign, like the fact that Coca-Cola sells poison in a can to children with images of polar bears, and McDonald's can use the word fresh in a sentence with their food and not just instantly be rejected. Oh, that comes as a result of decades of the gradual erosion of people's ability to use words through image based marketing.
And what's more, it is also responsible for sort of this inoculation that we now see in people, where we have Trump calling out fake news and sort of making it a subject of national importance, of course, in a self-interested attempt to win the political office. But the effect of it nonetheless is that the sort of the one side of the information or of the political spectrum has become suddenly and violently aware of this problem, which is a real problem, and has decided, and justifiably so, to inoculate themselves against any information that is on the other side of the spectrum or that has the appearance of being on the other side of the spectrum, and as such has sort of cut off the ties to half the country to have real conversation. And it's not just a problem on that side. The problem is the same on the other side, except that on the other side, so the dislike is not about fake news, but about the person who is calling it out. So, and that's really sort of the connection that we were alluding to earlier, also about the allure of fascism and the problem of people not having their own perspective and falling prey to those deep regularities that structure the experience, that when then the time comes that somebody calls it out, they can gain the political power from calling that issue out, justifiably so, and become an idol of attention that can then push through all kinds of other political programs.
Yeah, right. I think you're both saying something that in a really eloquent way that is a sort of repeat of a simple statement that I've been making on the show about visual programming for over a year now. And it recently came up on a bonus show that we did. We were doing an analysis of this music video, that Childish Gambino, This Is America. I don't know if you guys saw that. It was like the biggest thing on YouTube a couple of months ago. And I was saying, this as audio does not make any sense, right? Like, it's to the average listener, a lot is going to be lost in this entire presentation if they only hear the song. So the visuals are extremely important. But this extends to all kinds of YouTube channels with a political agenda, to the mainstream media. The visual component of this is absolutely essential. And I've seen more and more of this. And I'm suspicious this is a relatively new phenomenon in political or philosophical discourse. But
it's been democratized.
Over the last 5 years, I have never seen so many people so passionate and in some cases so vitriolic about what they stand for and what they oppose without any ability to use words to back up those feelings. Visual messaging creates feelings that stick with a person. Feelings stick with a person longer than I think anything beyond the essences of the information that goes with those visuals or with those feelings. All of that stuff is forgotten first, if not immediately. And what people are left with is very strong feelings that they want to talk about as far as naming the feelings goes, but then they can't do anything to use words to defend those feelings.
Yes, we encounter this as what seems like a new phenomenon. I would say that it's actually an ancient phenomenon that we had conquered, and then the very bad genie got out of the bottle again.
Agree.
And I think that this is, in large part, that has been enabled by imagery production technology. So we encountered the world, mediated the world principally through text for centuries and centuries. And then the advent of photography and then video suddenly made it possible to do a lot of expression that previously was really only possible through theater, and theater itself was scripted through text. So this is the first time really in a very, very long time, I mean, since really before the advent of alphabetic writing, that we have had a world where there was an expectation that you could express meaningful things outside of text. And this has come at an extraordinary, I mean, it sort of whipped us up very quickly without, I don't think anybody realized it was happening when it was happening. I mean, of course, there's the famous example of the Kennedy-Nixon debate, 1960 election, when the people that listened to the debate on the radio thought that Nixon won, and the people that watched it on television thought that Kennedy won.
Right.
That's kind of the canonical example of these sort of things. But it's a very old problem that was well understood by ancient thinkers that were trying to construct society and civilization, that we sort of have neglected that there was some reason behind that. I mean, I don't think ultimately there's a legitimate criticism, for example, that literacy tests as a prerequisite for voting were a mechanism of racism and social control. And certainly there's an element to that, but there is also a logic to literacy tests. I mean, so and part of the trouble today is that we have people on both sides of these issues that are being intellectually dishonest. So I would say that this intellectual dishonesty is kind of like the burr under my saddle at the moment, because there are a lot of people out there saying things like coming to conclusions that are not so dissimilar from my own, but they're getting there not very honestly. And I'm perhaps more annoyed by them than I am from the people that I overtly disagree with the conclusions. For example, you know, there are people that say, well, there was no racism at all embedded in things like literacy tests, let's say. Well, that's probably quite dishonest. But it's also dishonest on the other side to say that it was only motivated by racism. There's a world in which a policy could be racist and have other motivations than racism at the same time, and we should examine what those were. The idea that people in a democracy ought to be able to navigate with reason the issues of the day, and it's really impossible to reason without language. You can't reason with image. You can have emotional reactions with image, but not reason with it. Well, then you end up with a world where nobody can use language, and then when there's a disagreement, we can't even get to the bottom of the disagreement. Like, there's no way to parse out why there's a disagreement if nobody can engage with language. And then the only thing left is violence. And I think that we're probably on a powder keg of violence that, when it explodes, will make the 20th century look very, very minor by comparison. But it is the result of several centuries. I mean, really, starting with the Enlightenment and the what I call the three children of the Enlightenment, which are Marxism, fascism, and consumerism. And consumerism takes fascist economics and combines it with Marxist values and aesthetics. That's what consumerism is. It's just fascist productivity with communist values and aesthetics. So this idea that, for example, information on the internet should be free is part of this set of communist values. But behind that, you get these very fascist censorship organizations like Facebook and Google that are more or less agents of the state. So we've gotten to this, like, consumerism is this younger brother of fascism and Marxism that sort of saw both of his older siblings die of, you know, relatively nasty deaths, and then kind of said, well, I'll take the advantages of each and try to learn from their mistakes. And so we have like this super virus now that responded to the last century of feedback. And it's very, very complicated to defeat. Impossible to defeat without language.
Indeed. I would maybe add some more context here as well that sort of ties it back to our current media landscape, which is that we currently see the rise of what some people call the intellectual dark web. And so this is sort of this idea that there's a group of thinkers that exist not only within the institutional context of media and the academy and sort of the state, but also actually outside it, and that have ideas that they don't rely on the institutional infrastructure for distributing. And as a result of that, and as a result of also sort of this video and audio being for the first time so available to anybody at virtually zero marginal cost, of course also having a very real cost behind that, allows now, for the first time, actually thinkers outside of the Overton window, outside of the window of allowable opinion, to have conversations that are not forced into a format of the one-hour debate on TV where it's highly scripted, where there are like 12 people that can each get maximum 5 minutes in, which is not a basis for a conversation that touches on any real issues or the root of them. And so this intellectual dark web is a term coined to describe the sort of general gargantuan trend of media technology making this conversation, longer form conversation possible, like you, like we here right now are having, where you can actually drill down and sort of come up again and connect the macro level to the micro level and have real conversation and disagreements while still maintaining civility. That's not really possible on sort of general TV and radio format, because they have commercial incentives to actually give you the advertisement again. And so,
or even in Facebook conversations. I mean, you can't even
absolutely.
Do this on our social media today.
Absolutely. And so that's been my experience, that I've had to deliberately and consciously structure my own experience on these platforms to act more as a sort of hack them in a way that they send me the information from all of these different places, these communities across science and religion, across left and right, across nihilism and lust for life, like whatever spectrum you can imagine, to actually have them serve me. But it's a very difficult thing to do. But now that we are in this place where it is possible, there's sort of the fight really comes down to how can we give people the advantages of this information economy, where the zero marginal cost does exist, marginal cost is zero, and how can we still maintain a way of regulating the information flow, not from a top-down perspective, but from a bottom-up emergent order where every single individual is sort of the source of their own building of their own experience of that new digital world.
Well, we've been outlining the problems that this Vaxios project aims to solve for the better part of the last half hour. Obviously, there's going to be obstacles to encounter. Like, people are going to say this is putting a premium on information, it's restricting information. Like, you must hear those arguments coming if you haven't dealt with them already. I would like to have a longer form conversation about the solution specifically. Like, we could do another hour just on that. Would you guys be willing to come back in a few days and continue this conversation just exclusively on Vaxios?
Absolutely. Would be thrilled to do.
If people want to learn more ahead of time, what would be the best resource for them?
Right now we have a landing page at Vaxios, VAXIOS.io. There's not any information there right now, but they can sign up, and we're going to be releasing our white paper very soon.
Excellent. And if people want to learn more about Exosphere or Mertz's project, can I get those websites as well?
Yes, you can go to Exosphere, which is EXOSPHE.RE. Just Exosphere with the dot before the RE.
Right. And then for the project that I'm helping bring into this world, which formed the basis really for Vaxios' approach to this problem, that's Holochain, and the website for that is holochain.org. And then there's the hosting market, which builds on Holochain, the first commercial app using that technology, which is called Holo, and you can find that at holo.host. And of course, also myself and Skinner are available at our respective personal sites, I think moritzbeeling.com and skinnerlane.com.
And your consultancy service is Existential Ventures?
That's right. I just recently, or rather last year, November, I believe, registered my personal company in Estonia, taking advantage of their e-residency program. And I can get into that maybe next time as well. And I help advise founders or visionaries like Skinner, like the people behind Holochain, on how to use communication strategy and technology to further and catalyze their ventures.
Awesome. Well, thank you both so much. It was great to talk to you guys again, and I look forward to continuing this conversation.
Thanks for having us, Brett.
Talk to you next time.